This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. End-of-life decisions can be difficult to talk about with family, friends, and physicians. But healthcare professionals say these conversations are necessary to have well in advance for the physical and mental well-being of patients. There are a lot of factors to consider in that process, and as Chris Thomas reports, it's better done earlier than later.
End-of-life plans touch on a range of topics, from the kind of treatment a person wants to where they want to die. Religious rites and family traditions can also be a part of end-of-life planning. Decisions may include whether a person wants palliative care, meant to extend someone's life, or hospice, meant to provide a level of comfort instead of treatment. It's something Dr. Helen Ransom wants her first and second year students at East Carolina University's Brody School of Medicine to understand clearly before they graduate. She teaches bioethics classes at the school.
In dealing with the patient, you're dealing not only just with kind of the biology, you're dealing with some of the social and contextual issues as well.
One of Ransom's students, John Herling, said end-of-life wishes should be discussed like other important family decisions. He lost his father to lung cancer, but said the last few months of their time together were more enjoyable, since the family discussed it ahead of time.
The passing of someone you love is just, it's another aspect of life.
90% of people would prefer to die at home. According to a study by Kaiser Family Foundation, only about a third of Medicare beneficiaries actually do.
From the time of diagnosis to his death was about 2.5 months. During that time, we had the best Christmas we've ever had in our family. We had he had a wonderful tour of the East Coast where he got to visit all of his grandkids. He got to see all of us, all of his kids once again. And then he passed in his home in West Virginia. And it was on his time, in his control, as a pain-free, very wonderful, peaceful end.
End-of-life discussions are typically difficult for families and physicians to have, even with Medicare-funded incentives.
These are discussions that are not happening at all or on time. Roughly, maybe between 25 and 30% of persons in the U.S. have an actual advance directive.
Ransom said students often have their mind on saving lives, and a class on guiding someone toward the end of their life can seem counterintuitive.
Ways that we try to get students to grasp some of these concepts is through something that's traditionally done in teaching bioethics, and that's through case analysis. And so we will present a case to the students and just kind of give them a chance to work through it.
Ransom also tries to keep things relevant by searching headlines. Right now, she and her students have been following Tahiah McMath, a 15-year-old girl on life support who was declared brain dead by the state of California in 2013. Her family has since moved to New Jersey, where the state allows them to keep her alive.
It highlights some of the issues of end of life and how everyone has a kind of a different definition. There's a personal definition, there's also the state definition of death.
Herling said these bioethics classes have given him completely different notions on the relationship between a physician's place, between life and death.
One of the larger concepts and something that I thought was so revolutionary to me, it's to shift the paradigm. Instead of fighting for the patient to live, you're fighting, and this might sound a little off, but you're fighting for the patient's death.
Ransom said communication about end-of-life wishes can be a major obstacle physicians face. Breaking down complex medical procedures and decisions can be difficult to explain to non-professionals, especially if the grieving process has already begun.
There's a small percentage of providers, but enough, who will say things in such a way that it goes over the family's heads. And so there's not an ability to kind of bring the information down to a level where everyone at the table can get exactly what's going on.
It's also one of the most common pitfalls for families and other caregivers. Ransom said North Carolina has legal checks in place apart from the standard power of attorney privileges. Power of attorney paperwork must be filed at a county clerk of court office. Fees vary depending on the principal, the person who's being represented, and how much property they own. Living wills can also be filled out and made official in the presence of two witnesses and a notary. Patients can specify at what point end-of-life directives apply, whether or not a physician can decide to prolong their lives, and whether they want to continue receiving hydration and nutrition.
In North Carolina, there is a hierarchy for medical decision makers. If there's no documentation, if there's not someone appointed by the court, then it goes down like a but the tier form of, say, family members. So if you're married, you go to your spouse. If you're not married, then adult children, your parents. So it does provide some guidance.
But if that isn't explicitly discussed and decided on beforehand, it can lead to clashes between family and healthcare professionals, perhaps at the expense of the patient.
Even with that guidance, so you may have a legal framework and to provide as for a surrogate decision maker, but there is still some reliance on the family's input as far as what decisions can be made.
A particularly famous worst-case scenario came about a decade ago with the Terri Schiavo case. Though a legal framework was in place, it became drawn out with a public debate.
There was a decision maker, her husband. But unfortunately, the circus of the media and other different political issues just kind of got in the way of, a private decision that the family should have been given support to make.
East Carolina University and Vidit Medical Center are hosting an end-of-life decision discussion on Tuesday, April 25th at Brody Auditorium. The noon event will feature Dr. Lucy Kalanithi, a neurosurgeon and author of When Breath Becomes Air, a memoir of her late husband. Registration is free, but required. I'm Chris Thomas.
Kenston, a city of 22,000, doesn't quite have the charm of some of the coastal towns, but it's steeped in history, and these days, revitalization, trying to create a new identity for itself. Granger Stadium has a baseball team again, there's award-winning restaurants and a thriving craft brewery, and the African-American Music Trails and the CSS Noose Civil War Interpretive Center delves into the area's rich past. Even though parts of downtown Kinston are prospering, many sections remain blighted. There's numerous abandoned buildings throughout the city, and there's the struggling Vernon Park Mall. However, pockets of potential in the form of vacant lots are prevalent in the downtown area.
Back last year, in 2016, we began realizing the number of vacant lots that the city of Kinston currently owns.
Chris Suggs is the founder and CEO of Kinston Teens and the new initiative that seeks to transform those blank canvases into community amenities.
Which is actually over 1,000, so over 1,000 vacant properties owned by our city government. So we began conversations with our city planning department trying to figure out a way that we can make use of these lots in a way that benefits both the city government and the community at large.
The 16-year-old, bespectacled Kinston native met me Wednesday morning on East King Street near downtown. Suggs started the nonprofit organization Kinston Teens 2 years ago as a way to create civic engagement and community service opportunities for young people. The nonprofit kicked off the Adopt a Vacant Lot program in February with a mission for groups to adopt underutilized spaces in the city and convert them into small-scale farms, community gardens, or recreation areas.
This lot we're standing at now is directly across from the Kinston City Hall on King Street in Kinston. It's a beautiful lot on a major roadway in town, and the possibilities are absolutely endless to what an organization can turn this lot into.
This site, on the corner of East King and South Independence Street, is an open grassy field about an acre in size. Four giant oak trees line the perimeter to my right, and a paved concrete sidewalk borders the property on my left. Ideas have been submitted on how to revivify this space, but Suggs has his own idea.
Considering this is a really large lot, or one of the other large lots we have in this program, I would love to see a kickball field in Kinston. So I absolutely love kickball. I remember playing a lot in like elementary and middle school. So I would love to see us just have a huge kickball field somewhere in Kinston.
So far, Kinston Teens has received 5 applications from local organizations interested in acquiring vacant lots through the program. The timeline for submitting an application to approval is about a month. Groundbreaking ceremonies are planned at a couple of vacant lots in the coming weeks. Suggs says organizations can apply for a grant of $750 in funding from Kinston Teens to buy supplies or get technical assistance for planning.
Once they submit that initial application, our young people review the applications and work with them to finalize like a layout and landscaping plan. Then we submit it over to the city planning department, who actually approves the final application and everything and makes sure there's no liability issues and that this is something that will actually benefit the city at large. And once it's approved by the city planners, they get the ball rolling and they can begin work on their new adopted lot.
There is no cost to adopt a vacant spot, but there are stipulations. No concrete or permanent structures. For a 2-year period, the organization is expected to maintain the property and implement their plans for the lot.
And then after 2 years, though, they can actually apply to receive the lot free from the city of Kinston if it's for a nonprofit purpose or at fair market value if they're doing some type of business venture off of it.
Way down the line, when the property is purchased, permanent facilities can be constructed. Lenoir County Planning Director Adam Short has been involved with the Adopt a Vacant Lot program since its inception.
We really want to do whatever Constantine's has as a vision for those properties. I think pocket parks, I can see, you know, community gardens, ways to possibly incorporate neighborhood solar development facilities, things like that.
Short says it's encouraging to see youth excited and engaged in projects that improve the community. He adds bringing new life to vacant lots makes Kinston more attractive for tourists, businesses, and for people looking to relocate to the area.
With everything else that we have going on, that we can spruce up any vacant lots that we might have, and it would certainly entice folks down the line to invest in those areas.
Kinston Teens has engaged over 100 youth, middle school to college aged, in a variety of community outreach projects, from mentoring at local elementary schools, leadership training, and cleanup projects along the streets in Kinston. The Adopt a Vacant Lot program, Suggs says, is just one more example of enhancing the city, at the same time providing a positive alternative to get youth involved in local community activities.
It's showing that, you know, despite, you know, the negative things you sometimes hear about our town, that there's lots of great things happening. We have the downtown area booming and growing. We have these lots available in downtown, the MLK corridor, that are just going to do so many great transformations through these projects that, you know, within a couple years, Kinston's going to be, you know, the place to be in North Carolina. So I'm excited about it, and I can't wait to see all this going to come.
Suggs will soon be graduating high school and starting college at University of North Carolina Chapel Hill this fall, where he plans to study political science and sociology. While he's at school, he feels confident the 30 members of Kinston Teens will keep the program going and growing.
You know, even though I'll be, you know, just an hour and a half away, I'm sure that I won't have to have so much of a hand in it because of the passionate young people part of our organization.
Suggs plans to return to Kinston in 2021 when he finishes college. He says he might even run for mayor someday.
There's going to be, you know, probably no more vacant lots in town. That's my goal in 4 years, that all the vacant lots are adopted.
I'm Jared Brumbaugh. As you drive around eastern North Carolina, it's not uncommon to spot wide open fields filled with solar panels. In addition to providing a renewable source of energy, the space in and around solar farms has the potential to be suitable habitat for pollinators such as bees, butterflies, and other beneficial insects. Today, Mac McKee speaks with the vegetation construction manager with Strata Solar of Raleigh, Catherine Parker, about their effort to place native pollen-producing plants at each of their solar projects.
North Carolina is ranked number 2 in the nation for installed solar power and many of the solar farms located here in eastern North Carolina. Now, why is our region attractive for solar development?
Eastern North Carolina is attractive for solar development for exactly the same reasons that it's attractive for agriculture. We have a lot of the same requirements as traditional row crops, and flat, sunny land is preferred to maximize solar collection.
Now, what are the projects that Strata Solar is working on now in development or it's already stalled here in eastern North Carolina?
Currently, we operate about 50 farms in the eastern North Carolina region and have about 4 more either under construction or slated for the upcoming year.
You're working with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission on recommendations for planting native pollinator habitats on solar farms. Can you tell me a little bit about this project?
That's right. So last summer, we were contacted by representatives from North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission to participate in a workshop that brought together several agencies, organizations, developers, and utilities. And the idea was to discuss the issues and opportunities of establishing pollinator habitat on solar farms. After the conference, we were working with Gabriella Garrison, who put together a list of recommendations for both low-growing and taller-growing native grasses and wildflowers.
What are some of the examples of native plants that provide the most benefit to pollinators?
So generally speaking, when making recommendations for planting for pollinators, research shows that it's best to provide a variety of plants, so a minimum of 2 grasses and 9 wildflowers that at least would spread throughout the growing season, providing a buffet for the pollinators to choose from.
Are native plants easier to maintain than, say, turf grasses?
Native grasses and wildflowers have deeper, more complex root systems than turf grasses, and they've adapted many years to coincide with local climates and local soils and water patterns and even pests. So as a result, once they're established, they typically require less fertilizers, less irrigation, and less pesticides to thrive. So in many respects, they are easier to maintain.
In addition to bees, which are excellent pollinators, what are some of the other beneficial insects you are hoping to attract with these native plants?
The Department of Agriculture suggests that by protecting and creating habitat for native bees and managed bees, that we're also supporting an array of other pollinators and beneficial insects, so butterflies, moths, flies, beetles, and wasps, and that's also including many natural predators of crop pests.
Is there a solar farm now where you're already placed native plants that's serving as a test subject, so to speak?
Yes, there is. So Strata has been enacting sustainable landscape strategies for the past few years. We primarily plant native trees and shrubs in our visual buffers and have incorporated white clover into our seeding mixes for all of our farms. The real highlight for me is the approximate 2.5 acres of buffer that we planted with an upland native grass wildflower and seed mix in March of last year, one of our facilities near Charlotte. And by July, the site was literally buzzing with activities from pollinators. In the first season, we were seeing plants like partridge pea and tick seed and blanket flower, black-eyed Susans. And it was and continues to be a very encouraging project.
Now, there have been some reports that some solar panels can pose a threat to birds by them getting burned by concentrated rays. Now, do the solar panels that seem to have any impact on bees and other pollinators?
No. So concentrated solar is a system that uses mirrors and lenses, and it focuses the sun's rays into a small area. It's primarily used in the Southwest and desert and is not used in North Carolina. All of our Strata solar facilities are ground-mounted solar collectors and pose no threat to birds, bees, or other pollinators.
Do you expect, Catherine, that planting native species of plants around solar facilities will become the standard for all solar developments here in North Carolina?
Natives have the ability to be a win-win-win for solar. We can have a positive impact on the environment, providing habitat for pollinators, controlling erosion, aiding in rainwater. We can have a positive impact on the economy by reducing overall maintenance and contributing to crop pollination. And at the same time, we can be having a positive social impact as we're being good neighbors and good stewards to the land.
Catherine Parker is the Vegetation Construction Manager with Strata Solar. Thanks for speaking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
This is Lisa Rayburn, Horticulture Agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. I often get questions from clients who want to know if they can start new plants from things that they found at the grocery store. As a general rule, I discourage people from propagating plants from these sources. Not that I don't want you to have fun and play. If all you want to do is see if you can make it germinate and grow, then great. Go on with it. But if you really want a productive plant, there are many reasons why you would want to start with the right plant and the right variety. Many of the varieties that you find in the grocery store are not suited for your area, use, hardiness zone, or growing conditions. While you can germinate an avocado or mango seed, unless you have a greenhouse, you will not be able to grow the plant to maturity and harvest any fruit off of it. If you just want to watch the seed germinate and grow, you can pot the seed up in a 6 to 8 inch container, put it in a warm location until it germinates, and make sure to provide the growing plant with plenty of direct sunlight. Ginger is another tropical plant found in the grocery store. While it's very easy to sprout ginger roots, which are actually compressed stems called rhizomes, ginger requires a longer growing season than we have to produce a mature rhizome. So if you want to harvest ginger root to use in cooking, you will need to overwinter the plant in a greenhouse. Work has actually been done in Goldsboro at the Center for Environmental Farming Systems on growing ginger in eastern North Carolina. So far, they have not been able to produce mature roots in their high tunnel production system. The next challenge is that some plants simply do not come true from seed. Apples are a classic example. If you save the seed from a Fuji or Red Delicious apple, the tree that you produce will not produce a Fuji or red delicious apple. This is because apples rely on cross-pollination to set seed and produce fruit. While the apple you are eating exhibits the characteristics of the mother plant, the embryos within the seeds will contain a mix of genetic information from the mother plant as well as genetic information from the pollinator variety. So you just don't know what you will get. Apples and many other fruit trees have a long juvenile period before it's ready to produce flowers and fruit. The period from sowing an apple seed to the first bloom and fruit production can take 5 to 12 years. That's a long time to wait before you know if your plant has edible fruit or not. The same issue holds true for seedling pecans and citrus. If you want to grow and actually harvest quality fruit, it is best to start with grafted plants of a known variety. You will get quality fruit faster as these plants have known characteristics and a significantly shorter juvenile period. Other grocery store items might carry diseases, as can be the case with potatoes, or be treated to prevent sprouting. If you really want to start something from the grocery store, I would suggest sweet potatoes. North Carolina is the leading state in sweet potato production, so chances are good that the sweet potatoes you are buying are a variety that can be grown locally. All you have to do is allow the sweet potatoes to sprout by planting them shallowly after soil temperatures have warmed in late April or early May. Mound soil around the growing sprouts to stimulate roots, and once the sprouts are 6 to 8 inches long, cut them from the sweet potato and plant the sprouts out in the garden, spaced 8 inches apart within the row. If you plant your sweet potato sprouts out in May or early June, you should have nice roots to harvest in the fall.
The town of Beaufort was among a dozen locations selected for the 2017 Bicycle and Pedestrian Planning Grant awarded by the North Carolina Department of Transportation. This week I spoke with Planning Director Kyle Garner about the project that will update a previous bicycle plan completed in 2009.
With the new bridge that's being built across Gallant's Channel, the town felt it necessary to update that plan, especially being able to take advantage of some of the traffic being removed from the existing street system, as well as we had the opportunity, due to our population being below 5,000 year-round, to add in a pedestrian piece. And our town is definitely one set up where a lot of people walk on a daily basis. So we felt it was a good time to actually combine both of those plans and ask the state to help us with some of the funding to update the bicycle piece and then add the pedestrian.
Now, currently, does Beaufort have sidewalks and bikeways? And if so, how much?
Sidewalks, we have several miles of sidewalk in town. Our multi-use paths and so forth are somewhat limited. We do have bicycle lanes, and there's actually a local bicycle route through the community that is marked. And we do have some on-pavement sharrows showing some of those routes. And then for others, we have signage. But we're hoping that this new plan will not only update, but help us enhance some of those areas.
With your joint bicycle pedestrian plan, is there a particular area that you're going to focus on first?
No. Actually, that's one of the things that we're looking forward to in working with whoever our consultant is that we hire, is that the community at large is going to help steer where these systems go and what areas maybe are deficient or need improvement. So, no, this is a town-wide, not one specific area.
I know probably funding is the first step, but could you kind of tell me the process? Are you going to have public meetings?
Right now, of course, the process began when we applied with our application to be considered, and we were fortunate enough to be one of the communities selected. We will now go through the contract process with the state. Then once we put that information out, we select a consultant. Then, yes, we will have neighborhood meetings where people come in, give their ideas, so forth, their locations of projects. Then the consultant would come back, share what those recommendations are, and then form it all into a formal plan. In the meantime, they would probably be working with a steering committee, probably no more than 8 to 10 people, and that group would actually help move both plans along to the adoption phase.
And along with receiving that money from the North Carolina Department of Transportation, did they require you to meet certain standards or specifications in order to do this project?
Absolutely, and that'll be part of the contract. There will be a scope of work in which they will expect us to do certain things. One of them would be a monthly report or an update as to where the project is, and as well as keeping track of the funding and making sure that that goes as according to their schedule as well, in addition to making sure that all people have the opportunity to come and participate in the development of these plans.
Kyle Garner is the planning director for the town of Beaufort. Thanks again for speaking with me.
Oh, you're welcome, Jared. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for listening to the Downeast Journal this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org.